Most of those are scared. They're not doing it for money. There is no money involved. So we have to debunk that myth right there. The reality is, when you are a whistleblower, especially against somebody powerful, chances are you're going to have to move. You're going to have to relocate. You're probably going to lose your job. You might even lose your marriage over it. It takes courage to be able to speak truth to power. And just like any other systems, but the systemic abuse on women, especially in this country, is astronomical. And that does play a role in child custody, in family courts, and abuse, and divorce.
You're listening to the Thriving in Chaos Project with Paulette Rigo, mediator, divorce coach, author, and founder of Better Divorce Academy. She invites you to grab a favorite beverage, find a cozy seat, soothe your soul, and take a listen. The podcast was inspired by our courageous journeys, connecting with others, having meaningful conversations, and impact through sharing our stories. In each episode, Paulette is joined by some of the most compelling experts in all things divorce and transformation. Prepare through the toughest chapters, reveal our hardships, celebrate our lessons learned, and see the future clearly. Leave feeling empowered to approach life and maintain our dignity no matter what. It's time to thrive in the chaos. Well, hello and welcome to the Thriving in Chaos Project, because you must thrive in the chaos. No need to get stuck in it. I am Paulette, your host. And today in the episode, mid to late January, don't know the exact date when we record, but here we are still in winter. I am thrilled to have Laura Joseph join me. She is the founder of Healing Spirit and a recovery and trauma expert. And let me tell you that the people that I work really need her expertise. So welcome, Laura. Thank you for your time and being a special guest on the podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting me to come join you on a very topic that I'm hugely passionate about.
I know. Now, Laura is up in the New England area, up in the South Shore of Boston, where I had lived many, many years. She's in the Hull Hingham area. I'll shout out to all my old peeps in that neighborhood. And she brings a professional scope as well as a personal one. So Laura, if you would be so kind to explain a little bit about your expertise, your education, what you do professionally, so that people really can understand what that looks like.
So I have been providing spiritually based integrative holistic health, I call it enrichment, since 2006. I kind of started on that journey because I grew up in a domestic violence home, and I was raped at 15, lost my virginity to a rapist. I was attempted at sexual abduction at the age of 12 in the town of Hingham. And, you know, I think at the time we grew up in a culture of keep it in the family, don't talk about it, you know, therapists are woo-woo, you know, all that stuff. So I didn't realize how that impacted on who I chose as a mate and what abuse looks like and how it looks like. So when I went to finally, and here's the other thing, I don't know how many of your listeners identify with this. I was more worried about being a statistic of a divorcee than I was about the abuse. I mean, it seems like counterintuitive, right? So I thought I could handle the abuse. I thought I could deal with the abuse. But I didn't realize, and sometimes we hear these, that sometimes the abuse escalates after you leave. And in my case, it didn't escalate in the sense of like physical abuse or like physical harm. It escalated in the use of family courts and child custody cases. And you know, a lot of, I'm not saying all fathers, because I don't really want to say fathers and mothers. It's really abusers and protective parents.
And I'm glad you made that clarification. That was really, yeah.
because it's really important. You know, I mean, I challenge when people go, oh, it's mothers or it's fathers. I think we're really missing that it's abusers versus protective parents. And the court systems are designed on a very patriarchal system that really, especially, and here's where the harm does come, where it is a sexist thing. Mothers are automatically disqualified in the courtroom by making allegations of abuse. And I actually spent $300,000 trying to see my kids on an ex parte motion where my ex-husband, and this is the other thing, you can go into family court, say whatever you want without proof or documentation. And to me, I don't care who you are as a mother or a father, to be able to give custody to a documented abuser that is backed up in court records and police reports, and to get custody without the opposing party in court is the scariest thing that can ever be done in a courtroom. Mm-hmm. And so I think in my journey, I was looking to heal. I started seeing a divide in my personality, and I started seeing a divide in who I was. And I knew there was something wrong. I just didn't know what it was and how I could be in one environment and I felt me, but I would go into anything having to do with this courtroom or litigation. And I'm like, who is this person? Who I was starting to become. And so I kind of labeled it as, how do I heal the broken me? And traditional healthcare I found wasn't working. So that's what led me down the spiritual path. Mm. And connecting into spirit and understanding, like, that was my journey, learning to trust spirit. Because when, you know, the battered women's shelter failed me, the courts failed me, the police departments failed me. I mean, my assault and battery records, literally, I mean, my story is like a Michael Crichton novel, because my assault and battery records, including the crime photography of all, you know, when they bring in the crime photographers to take pictures of all the bruises on your body, they all disappeared out of the police department.
Wow.
So, you know, and, you know, all these things that you say shouldn't happen, that can't happen, I could give you a case where it did happen. And so I kept saying, like, I thought I was living like this alternative reality. And so I did advocacy work, trying to figure out what was wrong in the judicial system. And I've built connections with people from all over the country that do this work. You know, the Battered Women's Justice Project is a great one. Child Justice Project is another great one. DV Leap is another wonderful one. So for those of your listeners who actually are struggling with domestic violence in the courtroom and not having the right lawyer who's addressing it, because it does have to be addressed in a certain way, you know, or else it just kind of gets muted. But those, I started building these allies, and then a Supreme Court case came in Massachusetts and I had to get out, where I granted custody to a documented abuser on the grounds that he had more money than she did, and knowingly granted custody to a documented abuser. And when you deal with case law, that became hugely detrimental to domestic violence and how we gain custody in the court systems and the discrimination that happens.
I'm just curious, what year was that?
2014.
Thank you. Okay.
Yeah. Wow. And there's currently, I haven't been able to find it, but there was a pending before the pandemic, another pending Supreme Court case in the state of Massachusetts, where the abuser didn't have custody. Apparently they, I forget the circumstances, but they didn't have custody. They lost custody because of domestic violence. And a year later, they basically didn't like paying child support, which is usually the number one thing. The abusers don't want to pay child support. Mm-hmm. So they find some sort of thing to bring about a change of custody. And so the lower court said that prior history of domestic violence could not be used in a custody case. And every court research, every legal research, every scientific thing that has ever been studied in domestic violence shows, including the ongoing A study, says that any exposure to domestic violence can cause long-term consequences on children that can lead to cancer, maladaptive behaviors, inability to hold a job, drug addiction, mood disorders, including anxiety, depression, all these things, cancer. And yet a lower court says that that shouldn't be a determining factor when it comes to custody. And so it's now a pending case, which to me would be very detrimental as a way for abusers to skirt the law when it comes to, let's just voluntarily give away custody to the victim, let them pacify for a year, and then a year later, now I can go into court and file for a modification of child custody, get custody because I have more money than the victim does. And by the way, my history of domestic violence doesn't play a role in whether or not that it should be a determining factor whether or not I have good custody. And that would be very, very dangerous to victims of domestic violence across, not only in this state, but it can create waves throughout the country. So I did that for many. So I started doing this. Next thing I know, like you're asking me like how I got into the work I did. I didn't go saying, hey, I want to do Reiki. Hey, I want to do healing work. Hey, I want to do meditation. It really stemmed from me just trying to figure out my own shatola, so to speak, and people seeking me out. And the next thing I know, organizations were asking me to be a part of things. And it just kind of grew from there. You know, it grew on its own. I mean, I didn't even have a business plan. You know, it just grew on its own.
Yeah. It found you. Yeah.
And I'm actually officially telling in print my first part of the story out of two books. The first one is called Feisty, Dangerously Amazing Women Using Their Voices to Make an Impact. It's a collaborative book from women all over the country. And I share in my chapter, which again is another surreal story, of how I was incarcerated without ever being charged, without being arrested, without ever being convicted, and with my right to a lawyer being denied to a state penitentiary because of family court abuse. And if people don't think that this stuff happens to domestic violence survivors and family court, it does. But how do we address it, right? I'm all about how do we find the solution. The solution is, one, we don't silence survivors. Because the biggest challenge is a lot of us don't think this stuff happens. And yet this happens to 58,000 children every year in this country. And it's the leading cause behind every mass shooting or the majority of mass shootings in this country, including school shootings. So if you really want to stop school shootings and mass shootings, for instance, we have to address how family courts address child custody when there's allegations of abuse. Do you know that if the abuser is a rapist, a child rapist and a pedophile, they actually have a greater chance of getting custody than just a domestic abuser in courts?
Can you explain that?
Studies have shown that if there's allegations, I think because of, you know, it's silence the victim or you're a liar. I think we have this victim blame. She must have an ulterior motive. She's lying. And there is a whistleblower judge. Her name is Judge Salcido out of California. She's no longer a judge, but I believe, I forget the year. I want to say somewhere between 2012 to 2014, because that's when I found she was actually a whistleblower judge in the state of California. Because she explained it was called a system. She did a series called Children Lost in the System. It was out of LA. And she talked about how when she went to judicial school, that she was taught to automatically disqualify mothers' allegations, specifically mothers, not fathers, but mothers' allegations of abuse when it came to divorce and child custody. And so she followed those rules because she must be on her period. She must be all these things when it comes to discrimination, you know, and actually the roots to those, I'm actually airing in my podcast in February. I interviewed a colleague of mine who wrote an amazing piece called The Burning Times of Witches, of how the burning times of witches influence white women culture of today. And so it really talks about the systems on our belief systems that have been literally inbred in us in our DNA over hundreds of years of why these systems exist today. So for those who want to catch that, but so she became a whistleblower because she had a custody where the mother made allegations of the father sexually abusing the child. and she didn't believe her. Well, 2 years later, that father was arrested and convicted of raping the daughter's friend. And so she couldn't sleep at night because she followed what the system told her to do and how to automatically disqualify allegations of abuse. Mm. So when that Supreme Court case came out in 2014, I literally said, I am not serving right now, because I was heading down a broken path of spinning. You know, it's fighting City Hall, right? And I said, how can I still be of service to the same population? So that's when I shift to healing. Because if we can heal the roots to this and we're not breeding the same toxicity over and over and breeding it into our children and to further repeating these systems, then we can't change it. You know, it goes into how do we change the bystander? How can we get bystanders to support abusers? Victims of abuse, right? See, this is the Freudian slip, right? Because of the conditioning. But it's how can we support survivors? Why do every time we see a celebrity that comes out speaking out about how they were sexually abused, we automatically say that they're lying? You know, it goes to all these systems. We have to stop that, because the reality is, most of those are scared. They're not doing it for money. There is no money involved. So we have to debunk that myth right there. The reality is, when you are a whistleblower, especially against somebody powerful, like against Cuomo or against a judge or against some celebrity, chances are you're going to have to move. You're going to have to relocate. You're probably going to lose your job. You might even lose your marriage over it. So it takes courage to be able to speak truth to power. And just like any other systems, right? But the systemic abuse on women, especially in this country, is astronomical. And that does play a role in child custody, in family courts, and abuse, and divorce, you know? And so that pattern has to be broken. So I've shifted on how, you know, for instance, how you present yourself in court makes a big difference, because are you going to be, you know, and here's the thing, if you are a survivor of abuse, you have every right to be upset. You have every right to be hypervigilant and be mama bear, right? But the judges go, you're neurotic. You're this, you're that, you're mentally unstable.
Right.
The courts are ill-equipped to understand the grieving skill. They just see that and narcissists and abusers know very well how to present, because they're very good at that game.
Sure. So beautiful summary of a very emotional, deep story. Personally, thank you for being so vulnerable and courageous and strong yourself and resilient to be able to rise through that and share your story to allow others to know whatever experience they've had that, and it's all going to be different, right? That they too do not need to feel that they are broken or they've done something wrong or that they're alone. Sometimes we feel a little bit of, I see people like, well, you know, nobody else out there has, experienced what I had, and won't there be a lot of judgment and finger pointing? And, you know, what is that, well, I think you alluded to it earlier, the shame, right? But the keeping up with the Joneses and not letting the neighbors know and keeping that so deeply hidden and embedded in the family system of your own early story. And then, of course, how that...
You have to break that cycle, right?
Yes. And that integration of that story transitioned or transferred or vacuumed you into your marriage, and then the situation that you had there with your own children and the horrendous experience that you had through the family court system with custody personally, that I don't see as a coincidence. You know, there's that congruency that runs through it, and that is unfortunate, but man, Laura, how common is it?
It's more, you know, one of my taglines that I say is this. because this is one of my visions. It's to break the unrecognized, I used to say epidemic, and I'm saying it's an endemic, of unresolved, unhealed, unrecognized trauma that is plaguing our, like, even if we're looking at, like, the whole COVID thing, it's the embedded root, right? And how do we create sustainable, because that's the key, sustainable systems of recovery, healing, and empowerment that are long lasting. They're not band-aids. And, you know, it was hard. I mean, I'm not saying, like, what we, you know, face. I look at, I don't even know how I survived what I did. Honestly, I look back now. Mm-hmm. I don't even know, because I can, like, I've given you still a G-rated version of all that I
adore. I'm sure you have, right? Yeah.
Because I was married 9 years, but I was in court every month being battered for 11. You know, and, you know, because this is what abusers know, they can't let go. And the systems aren't set up to recognize how. So if you can't, you know, it goes to the old saying, control what you can't and let go what you can't, right? Mm-hmm. So part of it is the surrender mode. And so when we can find a way to turn our triggers into a power instead of a disempowerment, that's one of the ways. Like I said, you know, I used to say, he can take everything away from me, but the one thing he can't steal from me is my ability to make a difference in somebody else's life. And no judge can take that away. So it was clinging on to those elements is what powered me through it. You know, and now I try to teach others how to rediscover that power that we've all sequestered, whether you are a victim of abuse or not. Because I think women in general have been sequestering their power because of a culture dynamic. And these are systems that we don't even recognize because we've normalized it. Just like a lot of survivors of abuse, sometimes, especially if we grew up in abusive households, we've normalized abuse. We don't know what a healthy relationship looks like. We don't know what normal, so-called normal living looks like. Right. So it's to rediscover that power that is really embedded, that's lying within, and to find the treasure that's buried in the shadows, right? Because when we can make peace with that shadow aspect, and we can become our own superhero. Like I look at Wonder Woman, you know, in that first Wonder Woman movie, right? At the end, she thought she was all this until she had to come across her nemesis, and she had to face her shadow before she really discovered her true power.
I love it. Now, for someone that didn't grow up in this, you know, experience, but still is really feeling a sense of heaviness or burden of just the shock and the weight of a breakup and a divorce. And they're normally, I see in the work I do, they will either tell a friend or a parent or a neighbor or a sister or an aunt, a cousin, the hairdresser, you know, the realtor, because that's sometimes the first one that knows, because the house has to be put on the market, or some professional, and they'll, you know, start to share a little bit, and maybe they keep it to themselves a little more, and maybe they find somebody they trust, and maybe they'll go to a therapist, a social worker, a psychologist, a psychiatrist, who knows, maybe even their own Western doctor when they say, I can't sleep, I have chronic headaches, my stomach hurts, I've lost weight or gained weight, and I don't have any energy, and you know, I'm anxious, I'm depressed, whatever the list is of symptoms that they're experiencing. It could be a skin rash, it could be just superficial things, right, that really aren't, but
everything
that's how
shows
they
up.
Slowly start to manifest from something, from hair falling out.
It can show up as chronic illness.
Right. Chronic illness. Right. Just in any way, I see a lot of this epidemic that we're seeing of irritable bowel and food allergies. And, you know, there's many other things that just sort of manifest, but whatever the symptoms are, and it will be different for everybody. And they go and get that addressed, and maybe they're given a prescription or not, or some sort of, remedy, shall we call it, to whatever that specific complaint is, right, or symptom that they're experiencing. But I don't see that it's really addressing anything that you shared about normalizing things and the rediscovering the power and making peace with the dark. And I've got all these amazing quotes that I wrote down as you were just eloquently sharing. So how do you suggest, first of all, if somebody were to have the good fortune of finding you or someone like you, and I'm sure you can work with people all over the country now, as I do too, or even the world, what does that initial experience feel like? What should they expect? What might it look like? Because there's so much mystery. They normally, and when I say they, you know, just all of people that are not familiar with this and the good and the impact and the difference it makes, they don't know what to expect. The normal is you call the doctor, make an appointment, you go, you explain your symptoms, and they give you a prescription and you leave. Whereas, okay. Well, not to voice my own personal opinions on what that or may not be beneficial, but they're not used to the alternative to that, right? And I do talk in Better Divorce Blueprint a lot about alternative, unconventional type of experiences that can be very helpful. So what does it look like if you could kind of just walk them down the path a little bit of working with you? What does that process look like so that they feel a little more comfortable and more in the know of, this is what you should expect?
So it's not as easy as be saying what to expect. I think it needs to be more reframed of,
okay,
those that come seek me. I've recognized that what they're doing may not be working. Okay. And I look at it as if we have a three-legged stool and the seat represents the whole of who we are. Each leg represents one aspect. One leg represents the physical self. So if we're having physical symptoms, we see a physician for that, right? So we got irritable bowel, they may give us a medication or whatever else, or to check to make sure there's nothing else more serious going on, right? We see a doctor for that, physical symptoms. If we're having mental, psycho-emotional stuff, we see a therapist or maybe our rabbi or maybe our priest for therapy, right? To help us address those needs. And the third leg is the spiritual, and the rabbi can kind of, and the priest and stuff like that, and the spiritual counseling can all go there. But that's also where I find things like acupuncture, yoga, Reiki, mindfulness. Those are all the spiritual things, right? It's how are we connecting with that soul piece part of us? And here's the thing, we've got IBS. And I grew up in a family of osteopaths. So, you know, I was always drilled early on as a child, address the root, address the root, address the root. Western systems are trained on just, here's a Band-Aid, here's a Band-Aid, here's a Band-Aid, here's a Band-Aid. It'll help you, but it's never going to address the root. Until you address the root, you're still going to be repeating cycles, okay? So, or perpetuating something where later you just get sicker and sicker. So if you have one leg that is not being addressed with that IBS, you may be saying, well, you know, you're seeing a therapist and you're seeing a doctor, but maybe you're not addressing your spiritual needs, right? Then the stool can't stand, which means that you cannot become whole. And I think that's what's missing, you know, or I'm so into my spiritual self and I am anti-doctor and I see a therapist, but I am anti-doctor, then you still can't become whole. So it's all about how do we become whole. And one of the things that I try to do is on the first session is address what's working, what's not working. So that way I can say, you need to go back and talk to your doctor about this, or you need to go back and talk to your therapist about that. And I can help you take care of and address the spiritual needs, right? Because that's what I'm technically trained in. But I'm also trained in how do we triage? So it's like, you know, and how do I get their doctors or their therapists on board so we can all be on the same page?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as far as what I do, it's very different for every person, because the hardest part is I have to try to figure out how somebody processes something mm-hmm. and try to tap into that. So, you know, some people process things physically, like I process my trauma and my PTSD very physically. Now, did I still have anxiety? Yes. But the major, more traumatic symptoms that I, because I thought I could control the anxiety, everything else was showing up physically for me. Mm-hmm. So I was having a lot of physical symptoms. Like I was choking on water to the point that I couldn't breathe. Okay. Mm-hmm. So it was a lot of severe, like things like that. Mm-hmm. You know, they wanted to do a hysterectomy on me. And when I finally asked my OBGYN if it was PTSD related, mm-hmm. that how is a hysterectomy going to fix it? And they said that it won't. And I said, well, then I'm going to keep my uterus and figure out how to fix it. And I still have my uterus today. So, you know, it's knowing how to, it's really developing the holism. I mean, I'm trained, my teachers are out of Kyoto, Japan. So I come from that, a lot of which are very rooted in Japanese Shinto and Japanese Buddhist healing modalities and philosophies. So, and then I have my father who was an osteopath. So apprenticing with him for probably almost 20 years in a medical environment, I've got both mindsets and skill sets that have really honed in. And then I have my journey in trainings and everything else in the trauma healing and recovery aspect. And I'm currently trying to complete my certification in addiction counseling, because I think trauma and addiction run hand in hand. And I saw a lot of others wrongfully incarcerated. This is the gift that I guess I was given when I went to Framingham, is I couldn't believe how many mothers were wrongfully incarcerated as a legal tactic in a custody dispute. Okay. Mm-hmm. As a chess piece. Okay.
Yeah.
And then what would happen is, some of these mothers didn't even develop alcoholism or drug addiction until they were met with court abuse. Mm. So this is where, and I just didn't understand addiction. So I just feel like I needed that, again, as a training and as a skill set to know if, how do we either circumvent? Because for me, I felt like the spiritual stuff really helped me in my early stages to help me stay grounded enough. I wasn't needing to self-medicate.
Right. Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I look at that, somebody saved me from above, you know, because my heart breaks where those that feel the need to self-medicate, maybe because it is real, you know, and then sometimes leads to addiction. And then now they say, oh, now we have just cause to take away your kids, because the pattern of abuse was never broken to begin with.
Yeah. It's such a catch 22 in a cycle that is difficult to end and easy to perpetuate. I love the visual of the three-legged stool, because it's so true that you can't just see yourself as one entity of being a physical body, right? My bones, my skin. Yes, we are physical bodies, and we do have tissue and organs and 14 systems of the body, if I remember from my biology classes, but all the training I've had for years. But yoga anatomy is a little different than physical anatomy too. So that's a whole nother topic, the energy bodies as well as the physical body. But you know, if you do not have the psychological, mental, emotional stability, the resiliency and the self-study and the understanding of the self, and like you said, how you process things, how you see and assimilate and digest and process, right? Kind of like our food, we have to see it and chew it and taste it and, you know, gather all the nutrients out of it and throw away what doesn't serve you, right? It's a process.
I mean, that's even one thing, right? You just talked about chewing. Mm-hmm. How many of us chew just to get it done because we're in a hurry?
Right. Not absorbing really all the goodness.
We're not masticating. There's a term called mastication. Mm-hmm. We have digestive enzymes that helps us absorb the nutrients. It starts right in our mouth. So it's little things like that, right?
Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I mean, I remember when I was teaching anatomy and physiology in a college setting, I asked one of the doctors, we teach all these body systems, but why don't we teach the electrical conduction system?
Mm-hmm.
Because without that, the nervous system doesn't work. The other organs don't work, you know, and yet that's the system that helps regulate everything.
And we wonder why people have constipation and bellyache and irritable bowel and ulcers and all kinds of other digestive issues. I studied macrobiotics, and one of my mentors, one of my teachers there, Lino Stankovic, I think he's probably 90 now. He sat across from me at lunch one day, and in macro, you have to chew your food, or you're supposed to chew every mouthful 100 times. It is so incredibly difficult. The idea is to get the food liquid so that every fiber and nutrient and vitamin and enzyme gets immediately into the bloodstream, because we do have, I don't know how many cells in our mouth that it goes directly. If you cut your mouth, it bleeds immediately because the blood is so close right to the surface. Yeah. So you can scratch your arm and maybe not bleed, but you scratch the inside of your mouth. And well, you know, even with a toothbrush or a dental floss, you can cause your mouth to bleed. And it is so hard, everybody. I challenge you, try to chew 100 times. It's time consuming. But I have to say that the digestion is so natural when you do that. You're all of a sudden, all of your organs are screaming, thank you for doing it. And it kind of forces you to sit up tall and be more aware of your posture and breathing. And you can almost see the digestion. Give it a shot. So, and lastly, the spiritual, you know, leg of the stool, because you have to see yourself as an energetic being here on the universe. We are here to be of purpose, of service, of meaning, of contribution. We aren't just skin and bones and emotions. We're there's more to it. So all you got to have the three legs of the stool.
Well,
so
I actually see the electrical conduction system, that anatomy piece, in the spiritual body, because that is the piece. Because I usually do this question when I do like lectures and things on trauma healing. I say, what allows your heart to pump? And you'd be surprised how many nurses, doctors, like, because they get so into the technical, they forget the basics, right? And I said, you have two nodes called the sinoatrial node and the atrial node that self-generate electricity.
Yeah.
That gives you boom, 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 boom.
It's an electrical pulse, no?
But it's self generating. So where does that electrical pulse actually come from? Well, it comes from the soul.
The spirit.
So this is why when we look at even physical symptoms, like, you know, it's more than just, oh, it's just my physical body. No, because even the gut, I mean, I love Mark Hyman's work because, you know, I've been following for years, but I love how he's finally coming out with things like how to heal the broken brain and all these things, because the stuff I've been talking about the mind gut health, like, this is your second brain. This is also your intuitive voice.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Your gut is your intuitive voice.
So yeah.
If your gut isn't stable, then the rest of you can't get stable. So, you know, if you have IBS, then that's like your body saying, hello, you're not listening to me. And your spirit saying, hello, you're not listening to me. It's also the emotional body going, hey, you're not listening to me, because we're so focused on everything out here. And we forget, because society says we're not supposed to go in here for the solutions, for the answers, for the healing, all of that.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. I think I'm going to make me some miso soup for lunch today and just really.
There you go.
Yeah. thinking of Lino. Beautiful. And I just want to wrap it up. And before you and I could go on for hours about this, and it's such an important conversation about divorce and parenting and custody and the process and the courts. And it doesn't have to be hell. It can be better. It should be better. It's people like you that are advocating, educating, and empowering people to not have their voice silenced, to be able to have the courage to speak their truth. But again, there's some skill and knowledge you have to be able to do that. So I ask you, for those people that are involved or may be involved, and the beautiful thing about this podcast is people can go back and listen to episodes regarding whatever topic is pertaining to them at the time. So keeping that in mind, what is the best way for victims of domestic violence to prepare for court so that they are not victims anymore than they already are? Yeah.
So one, if they can, make sure they get involved in a domestic violence shelter and support groups, because that's going to help. Depending on if the state and location or country and wherever they're at, and if they're dealing with like a restraining order type of scenario or that type of thing, they're going to want to have a domestic violence advocate present. Okay? Mm-hmm. So you want to make sure and ask the court that you want an advocate. It's not always allowed in family court, so you just have to look at the jurisdiction and see if that's a possibility. The big thing, if it's coming to child custody and family court, that I see is the biggest thing we underestimate is most divorce lawyers do not have litigation skills, nor do they have the skills of how to handle contested cases without driving up a very expensive legal bill.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a matter of asking, one, what's their litigation experience in contested cases?
Mm.
Because anybody can do divorce, not anybody can do litigation. Two, what's their experience on handling domestic violence or any kind of case involving any form of abuse?
Right.
And what's their philosophy on handling such cases? Because that's going to tell you whether or not they're going to really advocate for you and they really understand the challenges that victims of abuse go through in a court scenario.
Beautiful. Yes, having the right attorney, having the right advocate, the right support, the right team of experts under you, like as a foundation to educate you, hold your hand, support you through it. Going into it blind, unprepared with the wrong professionals is never going to be a recipe for success. So great advice.
I did it. I mean, I did it because initially I didn't have the money. My ex stole money out of our account and wiped up my checking account. Mm. So I didn't have money to hire. And I went on the mercy of others and didn't know what I was hiring at the time when I gave this lawyer a retainer, not understanding he was actually part of the problem. And even he couldn't even handle my ex's lawyer and all that stuff to the point that he threatened suicide in my case and then dropped the ball and blew my case. And, you know, and that's why I haven't been able to see my kids because he was... It was just bad. My case is such a soap opera. I mean, it's just, I can laugh at it now, you know, because it's been so long, but it's right. You know, you just go, wow, you know? So I would say, don't hire somebody because you feel like you're at their mercy and that you need somebody, you know, don't make that mistake because that could actually cost you more in the end.
Mm. And for those that are listening or stumble upon this resource and would like to follow you, learn more about you, learn from you, work with you, et cetera, what is the best way for them to do that?
So though I can give you two links. One is if you have Linktree, which is linktree.com or whatever that is, Linktree, and you just put in Healing with Spirit, there'll be a whole bunch of resources because I also do a podcast called Triggers in Spiritual Medicine, which has a lot of, I bring in experts that deal with trauma on different levels, whether it's through racism, homelessness, inequities, divorce, sexual abuse, all those things. And then you have my website, which is www.laurahealingwithspirit.com.
Lovely. Laura, healingwithspirit.com. You got it. Thank you, Laura Joseph, for your time, your story, your passion, your education, your enthusiasm, your advocacy, and incredible energy that you put forward for so many people that have the experiences and need the help in recovery and trauma recovery. It is so needed. Make sure, everybody, that you have all three legs on your stool, stable, you know, screwed in nice and tight so that you don't fall off your stool. Thank you again, Laura, everybody. Until next time, I want you to keep thriving. It's not an option. It's your homework. See you soon. Think you may be the next guest on the Thriving in Chaos Project podcast? Reach out to Paulette. Email her at paulette@betterdivorceacademy.com. And no matter what, keep thriving in the chaos.